Just back to some to the basics there, I mentioned that the voluntary pooling has to be done in good faith and also in accordance with lease terms. And so I have here some common lease terms that are relevant to pooling clauses, and I'll just go over them. I'll just go over some common ones that you see. The first, the pretty common ones are notice and recording requirements, which vary, but generally range from the requirement to give the lessor a copy of the unit designation or filing the unit designation of record in the appropriate county before the unit will be considered effective. If the lease does require that the unit designation be recorded, there are multiple cases that will invalidate the unit and say it's unenforceable if it's not timely filed, or at least will not give effect to the unit designation until it has been properly filed in accordance with the lease requirements, just depending, again, upon what the lease actually required in that case. Moving on, you also commonly see surface acreage limitations. Those are normally found directly in the pooling clause itself, limiting the size of the pooled unit. You sometimes also see leases, instead of directly limiting them in the pooled unit, the pooling clause, just reference a retained acreage clause or reference a railroad commission concept like a proration unit or other unit. The common law actually, in the absence of anything in the lease, the common law doesn't impose any kind of size limitation on a pooled unit. With the operator just being bound by the obligation to pool in good faith, and then, of course, also to pool as a reasonably prudent operator. So your size limitations are going to be found by reference to your oil and gas lease. And I'll also note an interesting aspect of unit sizes here. This comes up a lot in my practice with regard to pooled units and the reformation of pooled units. But Texas case law is certainly far from settled on this issue, but with regard to unit sizes and operators who need to change unit sizes, the case law seems to indicate that if you need to reduce the size of your pooled unit, you need the express permission of your landowner or the express authority in your lease in order to reduce the size of your pooled unit. And that's true even when your unit, even when your pooling language says the operator can expand the size of the unit or change the boundaries of the unit. Courts won't read into that authority to reduce the size of the pooled unit unless that is expressly granted. Sometimes you see restrictions on your pooling clause as to the types of substances that can be pooled. They're not super common, but in those cases, if you obtain production from a pooled unit from a substance that's not authorized to be pooled, that substance, of course, won't perpetuate non-drill site tracks in the unit. Almost all leases have a contiguous land requirement. This is, like the size limitations I talked about before, an interesting one in that the common law doesn't actually impose any sort of requirement that the land that's subject to a pooled unit be contiguous at all. So the common law has no problem with a non-contiguous unit, which is why probably most leases step in say, in order to have a valid pooled unit, it needs to be of contiguous lands. And then finally, timing requirements. And the most important thing there is to remember that the exercise of pooling authority is not going to do anything for a lease that has not been maintained in force and effect. So if you have a lease that has terminated pursuant to its own terms, any purported exercise of the pooling authority is going to be ineffective to perpetuate that lease. Okay. Now I'm going to move from talking about the requirements of the pooling clause itself to talking about the interaction between the pooling clause and other lease clauses. So the first clause I'm going to talk about is the PEW clause, which you're all familiar with. So before getting into the PEW clause, I'll just back up a minute and say for pooling, of course, just the fact of pooling, a valid pooling, will result in all production or operations anywhere on the pooled unit benefiting not only the lease on which the operations or productions occur, but all of the leases that have been included in the pooled unit. And historically, that has applied to the entirety of the lease, not just the section of the lease that was actually included in the pooled unit. This obviously permitted an operator to hold large tracts of land with a single well, a single unit, and perhaps the lease had only been included in the pooled unit as to a very small part of the lease. That's not a good result for landowners, and so landowners began to use what we now call a pew clause. And the purpose of a pew clause is to limit the effect of constructive production from, instead of pertaining to the entire lease that's been included in the pooled unit, to pertaining only to that specific portion of the lease that has actually been included in the pooled unit. So lands that are not included in the pooled unit, so if you have a lease that has a portion of the land covered by that lease included in the pooled unit, that portion will be perpetuated by unit operations and unit production. Other lands that are covered by the lease are going to need to be perpetuated by some other means that satisfies the lease clause. Pew clauses, so that's kind of the basic on pew clauses. I did want to highlight an interesting aspect of pew clauses. Pew clauses can be both vertical, which means they separate the lease by acreage, surface acreage, or they can be horizontal, which means they separate the lease by depths. And a lot of pew clauses are both. They separate the lease by both horizontal, surface acreage and by depths. So if, for example, you say you have a pew clause that says that the pooled unit will perpetuate the lease as to lands and depths included in the pooled unit, that's obviously a vertical and horizontal pew clause, and that's clear.